Welcome to the Myasthenia Gravis edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the MG community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're reporting from the 15th Myasthenia Gravis Foundation of America's conference in the Netherlands, and our guest is Dr. Sitara Ramdas, a consultant pediatric neurologist at Oxford Children's Hospital in England. Dr. Ramdas works in the child neurology department with a particular interest in neuromuscular and neuroinflammatory disorders. She also leads the pediatric myasthenia clinic at Oxford. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to speak.
So this is an interesting topic we're dealing with, which is myasthenia gravis in children. And myasthenia gravis itself is a pretty rare disease, and its occurrence in kids is even more rare. Can you give us an overview about this?
Absolutely. So myasthenia gravis, as you say, is a rare disorder, but actually compared to the myasthenia gravis in adults, the incidence in children is even rarer. What we do see in children is actually there's a difference in the incidence based on their underlying ethnicity. So in studies which are from what we call the Caucasian white population, the incidence is between 0.8 to 2.2, but in ethnicities from particularly Chinese or Black African, it's much higher, between 4 to 8.
We're speaking per 100,000?
Per million.
Okay, so that makes a difference. In general, myasthenia gravis, it's already rare. Can you give us a comparison between its incidence or prevalence in the general population among adults and that of children?
So I think the prevalence in adults, depending on studies, I think varies between 80 to 300 per million. Whereas in the pediatric would be, we don't have big prevalence studies, but probably would be a quarter of that.
So basically, we're talking about handfuls of patients in countries, right?
Yes. So yeah. So that's why it's quite rare. And because of that, the experience in recognizing this condition and managing is also not as much. And that leads to delayed diagnosis. And lots of these patients have a long diagnostic journey.
It's not like spinal muscular atrophy, which a test will show immediately a heel prick.
Absolutely. So spinal muscular atrophy is a genetic condition, so you're born with it. But myasthenia gravis, you're not born with it, except there is a particular type where babies can be born with symptoms of myasthenia gravis. But if the mother has myasthenia gravis and the antibodies have transferred across the womb to the baby.
So in that case, a woman who has MG is more likely to deliver a child with the disease.
Actually, no. So the risk is only 10 to 15% of mothers with myasthenia gravis have a risk of a baby having what we call transient neonatal myasthenia gravis, where the antibodies have crossed across the placenta or the womb into the baby. And these babies improve within first couple of months of life because the antibodies, you know, are circulated and taken away by the body. But in these mothers, if they have one pregnancy affected, the recurrence risk is up to 75%. So it's very important that mothers with myasthenia gravis are managed during their pregnancy by a neurologist, a neuromuscular neurologist, and an obstetrician. So this is only for the very particular type where the antibodies have transferred across to the baby. So in that, it's for the mothers to be aware and the pediatricians to be aware that the mother has myasthenia gravis. So babies, we recommend, are monitored in hospital at least for 2 to 3 days to look for any symptoms, which might be they don't feed as well, they feel a bit more floppy, they're not moving as much, and that might need the baby's required treatment. That's very different from what we call juvenile myasthenia gravis, where it's not, where a child develops antibodies on its own in the body, and then they present with myasthenia symptoms.
Just to back up a bit, the whole issue of women and pregnancy in myasthenia gravis is a hot topic, right? And so my understanding is that women with the disease may be reluctant to have children to begin with.
Pregnancy in women with myasthenia gravis can be managed very well, and women can, you know, go on to have, you know, safe deliveries and neonates. But what's really important is they're managed by a team who have the knowledge of managing myasthenia. That includes a neurologist, a neuromuscular neurologist, an obstetrician, and they all work together to make sure the pregnancy and the myasthenia management is optimal.
I understand. Okay. So statistically speaking, you mentioned some disparities among ethnicities. This is very interesting. Can you go over that?
So I think the disparity is that there are what we call genetic factors. So there seems to be certain what we call HLA association, which are...
Certain what?
So HLA, so how are you going to explain HLA? I'm just going to say genetic factors, yeah. So we do know that there are certain genetic factors in some population why they have a higher risk of having myasthenia, and particularly myasthenia, which starts at a very young age, okay? And it's not a genetic defect like you see in SMA, but it's just slight variation in the genes. So that is well recognized.
You mentioned the disparities among Chinese populations, among Black African populations. Can you explain a little more about this, and how much of a disparity are we talking about and why that is?
So the disparity is related to, I think we don't understand it fully, but it's related to that they have slightly different genetic risk factors due to which they have an increased incidence and particularly increased chances of having myasthenia in very young children. So if you look at large studies in the white Caucasian population, you know, juvenile myasthenia gravis accounts for about 10 to 15% of the myasthenia cases. But in the Asian Chinese population, it accounts for 50% of their cases.
So half of myasthenia gravis in Chinese are children?
No, childhood onset.
Childhood onset, which means that they developed the disease before the age of 18?
Yes.
And when you mentioned Asian, we're speaking mainly of China. Does that include India as well?
So we don't have big cohort studies from India, but the most big cohorts are from Asian Chinese ethnicity. So that's, yeah.
Okay.
The ethnicity. So not just particularly country China, it's...
The region?
The region, yeah.
And what about Africa? What are the numbers for sub-Saharan Africa?
So most of the studies that we have is from the group in South Africa, where they are, their large study reported, I think it was 4.3 per million, so somewhere similar to the Chinese. There are some studies which have looked, you know, from countries where there is mixed ethnicity, and they have identified from US and some from the UK as well, that the African populate, the children within those cohorts have a slightly different characteristics of the myasthenia gravis compared to the white Caucasian population.
I imagine that there's not a lot of studies out there, not a lot of trials or studies looking at pediatric myasthenia gravis.
That was true until a couple of years ago, but in recent years, we have had several studies which have included pediatric patients, particularly with the new, what we call biological innovative treatments. And there are several studies which are ongoing.
I see.
So for two new drugs which were approved, so there was recently a drug approved by FDA a couple of weeks ago called nipocalimab.
Yes.
Which is... particularly works on the immunoglobulin and, you know, how the immunoglobulins are recycled. And that was based on a study which included adolescent patients with juvenile myasthenia gravis.
So we have reported on nipocalimab in relation to hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn. And it's, of course, approved for that as well as FNAIT. So we've reported on that. Can you talk a bit about this, about the role of nipocalimab in treating MG, particularly with regard to children?
You know, what we have is a database on seven patients were recruited in the study and five had completed the study at which the data was presented in October, which was the last I've seen. So what it the study looked at whether the antibody levels come down, and that it did come down. But also they looked at what we call outcome measures to see improvement, both on what clinical assessments by a clinician and also what the patient reported, an improvement in their symptoms. And the study noted that actually there was improvement in both the clinician and the patient measures showed improvement. So clearly showing that the drug, you know, does work, not just reduce the antibody levels. But what is really important is also there were no serious adverse events. So the drug seems to have a relatively good safety profile. But this is a small study with a small population. Obviously, we'll need to see how that is when we use it in wider population on a clinical.
This is nipocalimab. And the other drug?
Eculizumab was the other drug that was approved a few years ago. And that was the original study had 11 patients. Again, showed improvement both in their clinical outcome called QMG and the patient-reported outcome, MGADL. So the adverse effects, which are already well-recognized with the eculizumab, because it works in a particular system called complement. So the complements are really important to help fight infection, particularly infection against the bacteria called meningococcus. So the patients need to be vaccinated for this, revaccinated every 5 years and monitored for infections and things.
Okay, and so how many patients do you personally treat with myasthenia gravis?
How many patients are... So at the minute, I've got about 35 patients under my care with my juvenile myasthenia gravis.
You mentioned that a lot of your patients are teenage girls.
So yes, so post-pubertal MG is much more common than pre-pubertal because my cohort of demographic is more of a white Caucasian population.
So how does the disease manifest itself in teenage girls, and how are they generally diagnosed, and how long does it take to get to diagnosis?
So the symptoms of myasthenia gravis in the pediatric age group and the adult age group does not differ. So they can come with problems with their vision, so droopy eyes, double vision, or difficulties with walking, particularly things like getting tired towards the end of the day, exercise, doing sports at school, writing, eating, chewing, those sort of activities. The diagnosis can really vary, time to diagnosis, because it's not been recognized in children as much. So I would say, in my experience, it can sometimes be several months before it's recognized, but you can sometimes have a very astute clinician who can pick it up sooner. So the symptoms can continue for a while before it's recognized that this could be myasthenia and the children are referred to a neurologist.
So we're almost out of time. Last question I'd like to ask you is, June is Myasthenia Gravis Awareness Month. How can you increase awareness of this disease among children?
Education, I think, is a really important aspect. So I think part of educating our medical students, our pediatricians, general practitioners of family medicine, physicians, to recognize that myasthenia gravis does occur in childhood, and to refer our patients early on when they present with symptoms that look like myasthenia gravis, because most would have seen an adult with myasthenia gravis, and, you know, that does occur in children. I think they just don't know that it is a condition that can affect children as well.
Any final thoughts?
I think it's important to remember that myasthenia gravis is a treatable condition, and we have very effective treatments. And our aim with these treatments is to give these children and young people their normal life back. So we should aim for that, and we should, you know, get them back to as much of normality as possible with the treatments.
Well said. We've been speaking with Dr. Sitara Ramdas at Oxford Children's Hospital in England. We're at the Myasthenia Gravis Foundation of America's conference in The Hague, Netherlands. And this is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.